The Jewish Sabbath versus the Christian Sabbath, are they the same? This is part four of a study on the Sabbath, and this will be the last of the series. Thus far, I've dealt mostly with the explanation of various calendar systems out of history, which have influenced Israel and her history. And I've tried to show some of the effects that they've had and some of the confusion concerning a failure to distinguish between Jewish history and Israelite history. I compared Israel's calendar with the Jewish calendar, and I showed what I believe to be obvious differences, and I think so much so, and so great a differences, and of such a nature as to make the two systems forever mutually exclusive and totally incompatible. So, this far in the study, I've stayed mostly in the Old Testament. Today, I want to continue in the New Testament, where we'll take a closer look at some verses which have seemed to indicate that Jesus, Paul, and others actually kept the Jewish Sabbath. We'll take a look at some of those. And hopefully I can show you how that those same texts from the New Testament, when read directly from the Greek with an accurate translation, actually say just the opposite. They contradict the Jews or anyone else who claim that the Saturday Sabbath is the real Sabbath. And it points out things that I doubt that one Christian out of a million have actually come to realize. Mostly because the translations that we have from the Greek into the English have missed it. They've missed it. And I'll show you how. So it's a very important thing, and very few people are aware of it so far. Hopefully I will make a few more aware of it. Now I know that there will be a number of people who will object to what I'm saying in this study, and most of the objections that I think will probably come or are coming, I've already heard. I'm aware of them. I'm not saying that I've heard all of them, but I must have heard almost all of them because I grew up using them myself. I was a Saturday-keeping Christian for most of my life, and I'm well aware of most of the arguments. For instance, I'm sure there will be some who will say, I don't care about all of the information about the calendar because I know that Jesus kept Saturday and that's all I need to know. Now, some of you that hear this study will probably dismiss the whole thing on that basis alone. And for those of you who turn me off at that point, just let me say goodbye with this one note. The calendar of the land at that time was the Roman calendar, which, as you know, was based on a rigid, continuous 7-day week cycle. It's also a fact that the civil laws of the land where Jesus lived and functioned demanded that everybody in that society honor Saturday as the weekly Sabbath. So Saturday was the Sabbath of the society where Jesus lived. Now remember, the fourth commandment says to keep one day out of seven as a rest day. And since Judea didn't function under Moses' national calendar, which had been given early at Sinai, but Judea didn't function under that calendar, they functioned under the Roman calendar, Jesus observed the fourth commandment by keeping one day out of the seven-day Roman week. Much the same way that Christians keep one day out of the seven-day Roman week of today. At that point in history, all the other feasts and national Sabbaths had been lost. Actually, God had taken them away from Israel because of her disobedience. And the only thing that anyone could do as far as trying to obey the Sabbath law was to keep a seventh-day rest day. And that can be done by anyone in any count system. All you have to do is count to seven. And that's easy. Now, that doesn't reconstruct God's original Sabbath plan that was in his original calendar for Israel. But without a national calendar system and without a system that directs the society that you live in, it's about the best that one man can do. Now this can be a little confusing also because of another thing that the Jews did. The Pharisees, in forming their Babylonian religion in the land of Judea, adopted some holidays which sounded on the surface like the Old Covenant feast of Moses. That is, they had some of the same names. They had some of the same names. But these seeming similarities were merely tricks, I believe, and they were devised and employed by these Jewish priests to help make their counterfeit religion appear to be genuine. Remember, Babylon copied Israel in many aspects, only they copied them in a paganistic manner. And they translated the righteous laws of God into unrighteous laws of Babylon and tried to make it out as if they were the same. The Jews are still doing that today because the Jews practice the religion of Babylon. But they devised and employed these tricks to make them appear to be genuine. The feasts of the Jews, as Jesus referred to them, were festivals which were based upon Babylonian principles and traditions instead of Israel in Bible traditions. Jesus called the Jewish religion the traditions of the elders. Notice that he called the feasts, quote, the feasts of the Jews. He didn't call them the feast of Israel. Turn to John chapter 2 and verse 13. And the Jews' Passover was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. The Jews' Passover. Now that's the same name that was used in the Old Testament, but it must not have been exactly the same festival, or he wouldn't have called it the Jews' Passover. He would have said the Passover for Israel, or he would have said the Passover or something. He wouldn't have called it the Jews' Passover. Also in chapter 5, verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Chapter 6 and verse 4. And the Passover, a feast of the Jews, was nigh. Now Jesus, a true Israelite, was calling this feast a feast of the Jews. Why didn't he call it Feast of Israel? Maybe there was a difference. To help explain this further, let's go back to the book of Hosea and a prophecy which tells what actually happened and why. And this should also help to answer others who will hear this sermon and reply, well, if what you say about Moses' calendar is true, then you don't keep the right day either, because you keep Sunday, and you said that the original seventh-day Sabbath would have fallen on rotating days of the week of our present calendar. But why do you keep Sunday instead of the original Sabbath schedule of Moses? And of course, another common rebuttal that I've heard many times, and in the past probably even used myself when I was a Saturday keeper, is, well, Jesus didn't say anything in Scripture about changing the Sabbath, and neither did any of the apostles. And anything as important as the Sabbath would have been mentioned at least by one of them, wouldn't it? So they must not have changed it then. You ever heard that? I've heard that quite a bit, and as I say, I think I've even used that one. I actually grew up with these things, and I can tell you that the Sabbath issue is the litmus test for Christians in the Saturday-keeping circles. It is a test of whether you're a Christian or not. You can do a lot of things wrong, but in those circles, if you do that one thing wrong, if you don't obey this fourth commandment according to their guidelines, then you're out. Let me show you what happened to Moses' calendar and the Sabbath before Jesus was born. In Hosea chapter 2, starting in the first verse, Hosea was told to take an unfaithful wife, a wife of whoredoms, and she was to conceive and bear children. She had three children. First of all, I might say that Hosea's wife was to represent Israel. Hosea was to represent God. Hosea's wife was to represent Israel. Israel was unfaithful to God. Israel played the harlot with other gods, and it ended in a divorce. God had to divorce Israel. Here, God is having Hosea play this out in stages. Hosea took him a wife who was unfaithful. She bore him some children, and the three children's names mean this. The first one's name means condemned, the second one's name means not pitied, and the third one's name means rejected. And these are the steps in what happened to Israel after her adultery. She was condemned, and then she was not pitied, and then she was rejected or divorced. It says in Hosea chapter 2, verses 1 and 2, that Israel was the mother, and then both Judah and Ephraim, which would be the two different breakdowns of Israel after the time of Solomon, were told then to plead with your mother. In other words, plead with Israel from where both of you came. Plead with your mother. Plead, for she is not my wife, neither am I her husband. So here you have two you might say, illegitimate children being told that they are not the children of God because their mother is not his wife anymore. So you have Judea, and you, or at this time it would have been Judah, you have Judah and you have Ephraim, both told that they should plead with their mother, who was Israel, and told her to put away her whoredoms out of her sight and her adulteries from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and set her as in the day that she was born, and make her as a wilderness, and set her like a dry land, and slay her with thirst. And I will not have mercy upon her children, for they be the children of whoredoms. Hosea was told to go to his brethren, the people in Samaria, the people in Judah, all of the brethren of Israel, and say, you are this day the children of whoredoms. Plead with your mother, and ask her to put away her whoredom, and perhaps then you can all be taken back. And it says in verse 5, for their mother hath played harlot. She that conceived them hath done shamefully. For she said, I will go after my lovers, and give me my bread and my water, my wool and my flax, mine oil and my drink. Therefore, behold, I will hedge up thy way with thorns, and make a wall that she shall not find her paths, and she shall follow after her lovers, and she shall overtake them, and she shall seek them, but shall not find them. Then shall she say, I will go and return to my first husband, for then was it better with me than now. For she did not know that I gave her corn and wine and oil, and multiplied her silver and gold, which they prepared for Baal. Therefore will I return and take away my corn in the time thereof, and my wine in the season thereof, and will recover my wool and my flax given to cover her nakedness. God is saying, she's going to want to return and act as if nothing has ever happened. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to allow that. I'm not going to give her the blessings that she once had. I'm going to see to it that she doesn't have them. And now will I discover her lewdness in the sight of her lovers, and none shall deliver her out of mine hand. Now there's judgment upon Israel. I will also cause all her mirth to cease, her feast days, her new moons, and her Sabbaths, and all her solemn feasts. A part of her punishment was that she would lose her Sabbaths. Exactly what happens when Israel was divorced, when Israel went into the nations of the world, she lost her Sabbaths that he had given her through Moses. She lost them. Now, with Israel scattered throughout the nations of the world and without a national covenant, after the divorce, after the rejection, Jesus, at the time when he appeared in Judea, had to obey the fourth commandment, but he had to obey it in a different way because they didn't have the same calendar. So Jesus simply obeyed the fourth commandment by keeping one day out of seven, which still is accurate by description of the fourth commandment. And as you know, the Ten Commandments transcend the Old Covenant, both in scope and time. The principle of the Ten Commandments are eternal. They didn't begin with the Old Covenant, nor did they end when the Old Covenant ended. So when you're talking about the fourth commandment, you're talking about something above and beyond anything implied in the Old Covenant itself. And with Israel's national calendar and all of the schedules of the tithing, the holidays, the debt release, etc., everything being extinct for over 600 years by the time Jesus showed up, and in the absence of that Old Covenant, Jesus could only keep one day in seven. And he was able to do that, and he kept it on Saturday, as far as I can tell. In Roman terminology, it was called the Venerable Day of Saturn. He also paid tribute when it was lawful. He also honored all the laws of the land when it was lawful, if it didn't go against God's law. He honored the laws of the land. And for him to keep Saturday didn't break any of God's laws that hadn't already been taken away by the divorce of the Old Covenant. As far as I can tell, his disciples probably kept Saturday too, up until the time of Jesus' resurrection. Jesus was resurrected on Sunday. And then there was a change. And when Jesus began his ministry and began to expose the national fraud of the Pharisees, the sparks really began to fly. He began his ministry by doing a strange thing. Turn to Luke chapter 4. You'll see here that Jesus had gone into the synagogue to witness to the men of that particular community, and he stood up to read before those men, and he chose to read from Isaiah 61. Now, first of all, his first breach of protocol there was that he wasn't even recognized to have the authority to stand up and read in the synagogue, but he did it anyway. And secondly, he told them something that got him a little bit upset. I can tell you that after saying what he did, there was no danger of him being nominated as the most popular fellow for that day. But why did he stand up and say what he did? He said it because he was beginning his search in that area for lost sheep. As you know, if you've read it, you know that it says that he wanted his ministry to begin first in Jerusalem, and then in Judea, and then in Samaria, and then to the uttermost parts of the world. It had to begin in Jerusalem. Now, there were Judeans of all different races in those synagogues, by the way. There were Judeans, people who lived in Judea, and they were of different races. There were even Israelites in those synagogues, real Israelites. And there were non-Israelites in there as well. There were Edomites in there. There were Judeans of various different races. But Jesus' message was to those who were listening. And you know, he said that his sheep would hear his voice, didn't he? The Israelites, who still loved God and happened to be there, would hear what he said and they would take heed. Anyone who heard it would be judged by their reaction to it. If they loved the Lord, they would heed it. If they hated the Lord, they would resent it, and they would condemn themselves by not listening and not heeding it. Jesus stood there that day and told them something that went much deeper than you may have ever realized, starting in verse 15. And he taught in the synagogues, being glorified of all, and he came to Nazareth, where he had been brought up, and as his custom was, he went into the synagogue on the Sabbath day and stood up for to read. And there was delivered unto him a book of the prophet Isaiah. And when he had opened the book, he found the place where it was written, and this is from Isaiah 61, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he hath anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor. He hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted, to preach deliverance to the captives, and recovery of sight to the blind, to set at liberty them that are bruised, to preach the acceptable year of the Lord." And he closed the book. Now, Jesus was referring to, specifically there, the year of Jubilee on the old calendar that God gave to Moses, the acceptable year of the Lord. Now, he was referring to the national calendar. Remember, there has to be a national calendar for this Jubilee to work properly. But was he referring to the national calendar that the Judeans were using at that time? Okay, look at verse 28. "And all they in the synagogue, when they heard these things, were filled with wrath, and rose up, and thrust him out of the city, and led him unto the brow of the hill whereon their city was built, that they might cast him down headlong." I told you he wasn't popular for what he said. Whatever he said here, whatever they took it to mean that he said, sure made him upset. Well, if he was talking about the calendar that they were observing, why would they get upset? If he was talking about Moses' calendar, that might upset him, mightn't it? Well, obviously he wasn't referring to their national calendar, otherwise they wouldn't have tried to kill him. But he was exposing the counterfeit Babylonian calendar is what he was doing. And he was exposing its corrupt economics. He was telling them that he had come to restore the righteous economics and spirit of the original calendar, based on honest weights, honest balances, and the national release of debts, along with some other things. In other words, he hit him right where it hurt, didn't he? He hit him right in the pocketbook. Now, the Pharisees had economic control over the people and political control. But they knew that they could lose that control right quick if Moses' calendar and the laws of Moses were reinstituted. Because it would mean that they would lose their system of unending debt and usury. That's why they wanted to eliminate this man right away. This Johnny-come-lately, this upstart Jesus who stood up there and said these things and demanded reform of all things and tried to uncover the corruption of government Now, some of you who hear this will probably be aware of how oppressive bureaucratic government responds or reacts when one of you goes in and demands a redress or reform or tries to uncover something that they're doing in secret. You may know how they respond to that. They don't actually repent and say they're sorry, do they? No, generally speaking, they try to eliminate you. They either eliminate your influence or they eliminate you. It's my belief that we have the same problems today. And I think that any halfway honest politician who winds up in Congress today doesn't happen very often. But when they do, it usually ends up with them either resigning within a few weeks after getting there, or they turn and sell out to the enemy, or they're so intimidated that they keep their mouth shut, or they're eliminated. And they have eliminated a few over the years. They have eliminated a few good congressmen. Happened many times in the last few decades. On my first trip to Washington, D.C., I had the pleasure of speaking to one of the few honest congressmen, I think, that were there. His reaction after being there a few weeks, he had just been elected, and his reaction to his stay there thus far was that he was considering resigning, and he told us that he didn't think he could take it. Now, obviously, he felt soiled by something, and perhaps guilty for being considered part of that corrupt place. And believe me, I don't know how corrupt the place is, but the people who are there are just like the Pharisees in Jesus' time. All the problems in our nation fall at the feet of those people elected to office there. There's nobody else that has control of this nation, those people alone. And I forgot his name after I got home, and I don't know what happened to him, if he did resign or what, but I did feel a lot of empathy for him. But the politicians of Jesus' day were the same as most of them are today. They're corrupt, and they hated Jesus because he demanded reform. And they called out the local SWAT team, and they brutalized him, and they eventually managed to crucify him. But you see, the Sabbath issue is pretty important, because if all that it entailed was simply deciding on which day to rest, I don't think those people would have gotten so mad at him and tried to murder him over that alone. It obviously affected much more than just which day of the week to rest. When Jesus pointed to the calendar for ethical and godly reasons and the Pharisees tried to kill him, that alone should tell us that his Sabbath was considerably different than the Pharisees' Sabbath. And there was something about the way Jesus kept that Sabbath and taught it that caused a lot of anxiety amongst the Pharisees. The Pharisees were religious, weren't they? Like Babylonians. Jesus was ethical. That's the difference. And he exposed their hypocrisy and made them look bad. The Pharisees were religious. Jesus was just ethical. Now, there's another common objection, which goes something like this. Oh, everybody knows that it was the Catholic Church that changed the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. You ever heard that one? Well, that's one of the very most common. And those that believe this often even carry little tracts written by some Catholic priests to verify that it's the truth, don't they? Have you seen those? It's always struck me a little odd that the same churches which decry that the Catholic Church is the Antichrist Church, the horror of Revelation, the very epitome of evil, and one that established Sunday worship, which they call the mark of the beast, it's always struck me a little odd that these same people who point to the Catholic Church to say that will turn around and present statements by Catholic priests as proof positive of the truth of their Saturday doctrine. Apparently, when the Catholics say they changed the Sabbath, they believe them. And when they say anything else, they don't believe them. Isn't that a little strange? It's not too consistent. By the way, here's the answer to that. First of all, the Emperor Constantine didn't change the Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday. Didn't change the Christian Sabbath from Saturday to Sunday back in the 3rd century. What he did was he acquiesced to the Christian pressure. And it was an act which he called conversion. I don't necessarily believe that it was a conversion, but he said it was. But he acquiesced to Christian pressure. And he did it in order to gain political power with them, political favor with the Christians. Do you think he would have gained much favor with the Christian majority in Rome at that time if he had demanded that they change their day of worship, forcing them to change the day that they went to church? What he did was he declared the commonly known Christian day of worship, which happened to be Sunday, as a recognized national holiday. That's all he did. And he did it as a concession to the Christian population. He did it to save them, not to spite them. Now, you study your history and you'll find that's true. It wouldn't make any sense any other way. Christians had been keeping Sunday, the first day of the Roman week, as their day of rest long before Constantine ever came on the scene. Here are the words of the edict that he declared, establishing Sunday as the national recognized holiday. He said, quote, "On the venerable day of the sun," now, Adventists will read that and say, "Oh, look at that, he's worshiping the sun." Well, it just so happened that that was merely a Roman idiom. It was their way of saying Sunday. Sunday was the venerable day of the sun. Saturday was the venerable day of Saturn. Monday was the venerable day of the moon. They had all their days named after planets. "On the venerable day of the sun, let the magistrates and people residing in cities rest, and let all workshops be closed." That's what he did. This was considered to be a great triumph to the Christians at that time, because Emperor Constantine undoubtedly made it in the interest and at the request of the church. No new day was adopted, as is falsely claimed. The first day of the Roman week, which Christians called the Lord's Day, was set aside as the weekly rest day. More witnesses abound as to the fact that Sunday was kept commonly in the early church long before the time of Constantine. And I might mention that the Adventists and some of those who advocate Saturday Sabbath tell us that Sunday was the pagan worship day and that Constantine instated the pagan day and replaced Saturday, which was the right Sabbath. Well, the fact is, Rome had been pagan for centuries before Constantine came along. The pagan days were already established. They were the days in Rome already. What Constantine did was he came along and he added another holiday, which in this case just happened to be a Christian holiday. Here's a quotation from a book titled A True Sabbath by, I believe his name is Foster. "The history of the church from the day of Pentecost for the first 300 years shows that the first day of the week, called the Lord's Day, was universally observed by the Church of Jesus Christ. The following quotations are authorities which speak for themselves. Ignatius Martyr, Bishop of Antioch, A.D. 69, 1st century, says, quote, "The disciples celebrate the first day of the week." That's before the turn of the first century. "The Didache, or the teaching of the 12 apostles, a writing which was came out about 75 to 90 A.D., still the first century. And on the Lord's Day, come together to bake bread and give thanks." And this is one of the earliest Christian documents. And this testimony is important, showing that this practice didn't begin with Constantine. It began many, many years earlier. Justin Martyr, A.D. 100 to 167, quote, "On the day called Sunday, there is a gathering in one place of all who reside, either in the cities or country places, and the memoirs of the apostles and the writings of the prophets are read." He adds, also, "We all assemble in common because it is the first day, and because on the same day Jesus Christ our Savior rose from the dead." And again he says, quote, "We are circumcised from sin and error through our Lord Jesus Christ, who rose from the dead on the first day of the week. Therefore it remains the chief and first of all days." Now if you read in Revelation chapter 1, verse 10, John refers to the Lord's Day. I have researched that and found that that literally means the Lord's Day or the Imperial Day, which is the same thing here referred to by Justin Martyr, referring to Sunday as the chief or the first of all days. Irenaeus, in 150 to 202 A.D., who was a scholar of Polycarp, by the way, was a disciple of the Apostle John. So you see, we're getting back there pretty close to the original. And he wrote, quote, "The mystery of the Lord's resurrection may not be celebrated in any other day than the Lord's Day, and on this alone should we observe the breaking of the Paschal feast." Melito, Bishop of Sardis, A.D. 170, says, "Today we have spent the Lord's holy day, and in it we have read your epistle." Tertullian of Carthage in A.D. 200, one of the most eminent men that the church has produced, says, quote, "Sundays we give to joy. We observe the day of the Lord's resurrection, free from every hindrance of anxiety and duty, laying aside our worldly business, lest we give place to the devil." And defending Christians from Jewish charges of sun worship, he adds this: likewise, if we spend Sundays in rejoicing, it is for a different reason than sun worship. We are also distinct from those who spend Saturday in idleness and feasting, leaving the ancient Jewish custom of which they are ignorant. Now, what he's saying there is that the modern day Jews were doing their observance of Sabbath out of context with the way it was designed back in the time of Moses. So he's saying that they don't worship the sun any more than the Jews worship Saturn. Maybe they do worship Saturn, for all I know, but that's, if Sunday is the day of the sun, and that means you worship the sun by keeping Sunday, then whoever keeps Saturday must be worshiping the planet Saturn. These indisputable facts from preachers, writers, and leaders of the early church make it quite clear that neither Constantine nor the Church of Rome changed worship from Saturday to Sunday. This evidence from the early church came before Roman or Romish church corruption had set in. These are from the first and second centuries, before the time of Constantine. Another reason I keep Sunday is because, in spite of the fact that most Christians have been led to believe that neither Jesus nor his apostles said anything about a change of the day, the truth is that they did say something. In fact, they said quite a bit. Let me show you something about the actual Greek text, which was completely lost in the translations into English. Perhaps the reason it was lost was because of the Jewish influence in and among Bible scholars. I don't know. But I do know that it was lost. I don't know what the reason was for sure. But it was lost, and it was lost bad, and as you will see. Here are some, but by no means not all, of the most cited scriptures. Matthew 28, verse 1. Turn there and read with me, and notice very carefully what it says. Matthew 28, verse 1. In the end of the Sabbath, as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. You see that? Now here it is in Greek. Opse de Sabbaton, at the end of Sabbath, ote epiphoskus, at the dawning, eis mayan Sabbaton, toward the first of Sabbath. In other words, toward the first day of Sabbath. The word day is implied. As you can see, the Greek says, first day of Sabbath. And the English says, first day of the week. Now, when the Greek New Testament was first written, did the writers intend that phrase to mean first day of the week? Is that the way that they would have normally said first day of the week in their language at that time? To answer that question, we can look at a Greek translation of the Old Testament, which happened to be in use in Jesus' time. It's called the Septuagint version of the Old Testament. It was a translation that was put into Greek from Hebrew by some Hebrew scholars. And this work was possibly even used by Jesus and some of his disciples in the first century. But this should tell us, then, if this phrase in Matthew 28 was a common Greek idiom meaning first day of the week. Because if it was, it would be in the Septuagint too. But according to T.J. McCrossan, who was a former instructor in Greek in Manitoba University, there's not one place in the whole Septuagint where the words Sabbaton or Sabbata were used to mean week or weeks. Not one time. Did the Greeks have a word for week? Of course they did. As you remember, I told you that the Greeks had weeks in their calendar system. So they had to have a word for weeks. In the Septuagint, we read in Daniel 9:24. If you want to turn there, you can read in your King James or in your whatever Bible you have there. In Daniel 9:24, in the Septuagint, it says, 70 weeks, 70 hebdomades, not sabbaton, but hebdomades, 70 weeks, 70 hebdomades are determined upon thy people. And then in verse 25, the prince shall be 7 hebdomades, weeks. And in verse 27, he shall confirm the covenant 1 week, 1 hebdomos. The Greek word for week is hebdomos, not sabbaton. If they wanted to say week, they could have said hebdomos. If they wanted to say Sabbath, they could have said sabbaton, which they did. Sabbaton didn't mean week, it meant Sabbath. Now, I don't think that's too difficult to realize. Quoting more sections from this book by T.J. McCrossan titled The True Sabbath, These are just a few of the many examples he gives showing that the Greek word sabbaton can never mean anything other than Sabbath. Matthew 12:5. Go ahead and turn there. I want you to follow these. These are very important. Matthew 12:5. Have you not read in the law how that on the Sabbath days the priests in the temple profane the Sabbath? Now the Greek expression here for on the Sabbath days is tois sabbathon. The dative case of sabbata, the very same word used both times in Matthew 28:1, where they called it the first day of the week. You see the inconsistency there. Mark 3:4. Mark 3:4. And he said unto them, is it lawful to do good on the Sabbath days? Here again, the expression on the Sabbath days is tois sabbathin. Again, the dative case of sabbata, the very same word used in both cases in Matthew 28:1. Turn to Acts 17:2. Acts 17:2. Paul went in unto them, and 3 Sabbath days reasoned with them. The Greek expression here, 3 Sabbath days, is epi sabbata tria, the very same word again used in Matthew 28:1, which is translated first day of the week in your King James Bible. Now he gives many more examples that are similar to these, which I won't take the time to read right now because they're all basically the same. But you see, there is a consistent flow here, and he has found it, and the King James translators lost it. I don't know how, but unfortunately they did, and we have a lot of people who don't understand that now. But do you hear what this is saying, and do you understand what it means? I want to quote more from his book. He says in Acts 16:13, it says, and on the Sabbath we went out of the city by a riverside, etc. Now, every Seventh-day Adventist admits that Sabbath here, in this reading, means the regular Jewish Sabbath. Yet, look at the Greek expression, quote, for on the Sabbath. It says, quote, te emeraton sabbaton. Literally translated, it reads, quote, on the day of the Sabbath. The very same word and the very same structure and the very same case of that word which occurred both times in Matthew, for the King James Bible called it the first day of the week. Exactly the same. There's no doubt that in the Septuagint, which is the Greek Old Testament, and in the Greek New Testament, that the true meaning of the word sabbata or sabbaton is Sabbath. It's not week or week. The Greek word for week is ebdomos. If they had wanted to say week, they could have said ebdomos, but they weren't saying ebdomos. They were saying sabbaton. They were saying Sabbath. They obviously meant Sabbath. Still quoting from McCrossan, he goes on to say, and now I want to prove to you that the New Testament always calls the first day, or Sunday, the Sabbath. So, you know, we're really getting down to the nitty-gritty here, aren't we? He says that they always call Sunday the Sabbath. Let's go on. Under A, he has Matthew 28:1, which we've already talked about, which says, at the end of Sabbath as it began to dawn toward the first day of the week. And as he pointed out, it actually says, eis mayan sabbaton, on the first day Sabbath. Again, Sunday, or the first day, is mentioned in Mark 16:2. Quote, and very early in the morning, the first day of the week, etc. Here again, the Greek construction plays havoc with our Sabbatarian Saturday friends, for it is the very same as in Acts 13:14 and Acts 16:13, where they all agree that the word sabbaton means the regular Jewish Sabbath. In other words, in Mark 16:2, they think it means Sunday, and in Acts 13:14 and Acts 16:13, they think the same word means Saturday. They need to abide by their own rules. Again, quoting from McCrossan, if our Adventist friends had any good Greek scholars among them, which they have not, Just one comparison alone would convince them of the weakness of their position. If te emeriton sabbaton means on the day of the Sabbath or on the Sabbath day in Acts 13:14 and Acts 16:13, then te mea emeriton sabbaton in Mark 16:2 must mean on the first Sabbath day. Well, Carlson goes on to show how the Greek bears up the same exact way in every one of the classic usages in the New Testament. Among them are these. I won't read them, I'll just mention them. You can check them out for yourself. Mark 16:9, Luke 24:1, John 20:1, also in verse 19, Acts 20, verse 7, is another place where Paul calls Sunday the Sabbath by using the same expression. And then in 1 Corinthians 16:2, Sunday is again called the first day Sabbath with the same Greek construction. In every case, in every single case, the Greek word is a form of the word sabbaton. It doesn't mean week. It means Sabbath. If they had wanted to say week, they would have said ebdomos, not sabbaton. McCarlson concludes with this. If the disciples did not want us to keep Sunday as the true Sabbath, then they certainly would have used the regular Greek expression for, quote, the first day of the week, which would have been either prote emerites ebdomos or emera mia tes ebdomos. Either of these expressions would have meant on the first day of the week, and there would have been no mistake, no confusion, but they didn't use that expression because they didn't mean the first day of the week. They were designating a special name for that first day of the week. They didn't call it simply the first day of the week. They called it the first day Sabbath, a special designation. Christ rose on Sunday. He appeared to his disciples on that same Sunday in the upper room in Luke 24:26. But the Holy Spirit was given out on Sunday at Pentecost. Paul honored Sunday in 1 Corinthians 16:2. Sunday was the day of meeting in Acts 20, verses 6 and 7. I could go on with more and more explanations and examples, but I think this should be enough for any willing Bible studier to take it up on his own and prove that what I said to be either true or false. You can prove it for yourself. If it's true, then I think our Christian brethren who have been misled by the Jews, the Adventists, Herbert Armstrong, the Seventh-day Church of God, sacred name churches, or any other Sabbath, Saturday Sabbath advocates, had better take another look at their Sabbath doctrine. It looks to me like they've been Judaized. Now, I don't know. I don't think that they're aware of it, most of them. But nonetheless, they have been Judaized. And to some extent, our King James Bible has been Judaized. You have to realize that when you see it there. God has commanded Israel to remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. And he has ordained that that Sabbath be a sign between him and his Israel people. God's Israel people became Christians all around the world when they heard the gospel preached. And they universally accepted Sunday as their Sabbath. If the Sabbath is a sign to point to Christian Israel, then that Sabbath has to be Sunday.